WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the highs and lows of meth. We talk with journalist Frank Owen about his new book, No Speed Limit, A History of Methamphetamine and How It Became Associated with Bikers, Mom and Pop Labs, and Mexican Drug Traffickers. He'll describe why people do meth in the first place and how it turns against them. He speaks from experience. Also, what the iPod has to tell us about the places of India and China in the global economy. We talk with Forbes foreign correspondent Robin Meredith about her new book, The Elephant and the Dragon, The Rise of India and China, and what it means for all of us. And we remember film director Ingmar Bergman. He died today at age 89. We'll listen back to an interview with Liv Ullmann, who starred in many of his films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Meth is the most talked about illegal substance since crack cocaine, the devil drug of the new millennium, writes Frank Owen in his new book, No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. Owen's book is all about methamphetamine, why people take it in the first place, and how it turns against them. He looks at how bikers started to make and distribute meth, why mom-and-pop meth labs developed around the country, and how federal laws succeeded in shutting down many of those labs. But there's still plenty of meth out there. Much of the business has been taken over by Mexican drug traffickers. Frank Owen grew up in Manchester, England. He's written for The New York Times, The Village Voice, Newsday, Spin, Vibe, and Playboy. Frank Owen, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your introduction to meth wasn't as a journalist. It was as a user years ago. Mm-hmm. Tell us what a meth high is like in the honeymoon phase.
Well, the thing about meth is it actually doesn't get you that high, except not in the conventional sense of the word, not in the dosages I was using. It actually makes you feel more sober. It kind of focuses concentration. You feel you have boundless amounts of energy. You feel you're ready for any task. So it doesn't get you like stoned. You don't feel out of it. It doesn't take you to some distant region of your mind. It's not about losing control. It's exactly the opposite. And that was initially the kind of the appeal of the drug to me, because I used it essentially as a vocational aid, as a work tool.
Well, it helped you write.
Oh, yeah. See, like, you know, most stimulants, like cocaine, for instance, to me, that blurs the senses. You can't kind of concentrate. You have to do a line every 20 minutes. Meth is kind of like set it and forget it. You can do it, and you don't have to think about it for 8 hours. And it actually has been proven to, you know, focus concentration. So you can read, you know, very dense tomes, very dense books, and you can get through them very, very fast. It's very good for writer's block. You don't get writer's block on meth. It also has this strange ability to make kind of mundane work seem fascinating. So that was, you know, the initial attraction of the drug to me.
When did meth start to go bad for you?
Well, you know, maybe 3 or 4 months into it. The problem with meth is that, you know, after a while, you suffer from these sleep deprivation hallucinations. And if you stay up for two or three days, even if you're not on meth, you stay up for 2 or 3 days, you're going to get some very vivid hallucinations. And that's not so much because of the drug, but because of the lack of sleep. And meth hallucinations are very real and very scary. They're not like LSD hallucinations. On LSD, you know they're not real. Meth hallucinations seem like they're really happening. And they're very much based in reality. They're not kind of freaky out there kind of hallucinations. They're stuff that's basically, elements from your reality kind of, exaggerated and made to seem fantastic.
And when things started to go bad with you and meth, was it helpful still for you as a writer?
Well, you know, it's as with any drug, there's a kind of law of diminishing returns. You know, it's always better at the beginning than it is at the end. But as the drug took over, I found myself becoming very increasingly irritated at the world, very angry, getting into fights with people. What started out as something I did to help me work actually ended up negatively affecting the work. You know, I would kind of miss deadlines and things like that. And also the effect on my health. I turned practically spectral from doing all this meth. I mean, clothes that I'd bought, you know, that originally fit me started to hang off me like funeral shrouds, you know. And also the paranoia. I mean, you can get very, very paranoid on meth. And so, I'd imagine people following me in the street. I'd think that people were taking pictures of me from the fire escape across the street. I'd hear voices in the hallway, children's voices whispering my name, and I'd go out there and there'd be nobody there. The paranoia, the anger, all that stuff really starts to kick in, and then it no longer becomes a kind of a vocational aid. It becomes something that actually harms your vocation.
My guest is journalist Frank Owen, and he's the author of the new book, No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. Your book is in part a history of meth, mm-hmm. And, you know, you trace how it spread. And the accessibility of meth has had a lot to do with how easy it used to be to make it.
Right.
Tell us about how meth is made and why it was easy before certain prohibitions were put into effect, why it was so easy to create a home meth lab.
Well, it was actually the prohibitions that made it easier to make meth, because meth in the old days, back in the 60s and the 70s, was a complicated process. It was made using something called phenylacetone, P2P, and you needed sophisticated laboratory equipment to make it. You couldn't just cook it up at home. But basically, the feds put P2P, made it a controlled substance in 1980, and that forced underground chemists to find out another way to make meth. And that's when they discovered how to make it using ephedrine and pseudoephedrine. And that's the so-called ephedrine reduction method. That is what inaugurated this whole era of so-called kitchen chemistry, because making meth with ephedrine is a lot easier to make than with P2P. You can make meth using just ordinary household items, you know, stuff you can get at the drugstore, stuff you can get at the hardware store. But what's really interesting about that is that the ephedrine reduction method actually makes the drug twice as powerful. So ironically, by cracking down on the old biker meth, the P2P meth, they ended up producing a drug that was not only easier to make, but also was twice as strong.
And it's made from the pseudoephedrine in cold medicine.
Right, right. That's one way to make it. There are other ways, but that's the way kitchen chemists, people who make it in the kitchen or in their garage, that's how they make meth, yes.
So was the chemistry part how to separate the ephedrine from the rest of the cold medicine tablet?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be easy because you used to be able to just buy pure ephedrine tablets. But what happened, of course, is that the pharmaceutical companies caught on to the fact that that people were using these legal medicines to make meth. So they start adding all these kind of harmless additives. So you basically, in order to make it these days using that way, you have to separate out all the gunk that comes with the ephedrine, which actually takes longer than actually making the meth itself.
In your book, you write about the history of meth.
Right.
And it was legal for uh-huh. several decades. When was it legal, and what was it used for?
It was legal right up to 1970. And it was used for a wide variety of ailments. Somebody once totted them all up, and I think it was about 40, 42 different ailments. And it was used for everything from curing hiccups to weight loss to treating alcoholism to treating heroin addiction to treating Parkinson's disease. So it was initially regarded as something of a wonder drug. But eventually, of course, it became really kind of America's first lifestyle drug. After a while, most of the meth being consumed was things like to lose weight, to gain a little bit of energy. Housewives used it a lot, for instance, to treat depression. I mean, methamphetamine was prescribed by doctors quite legally to pregnant women.
Now, you're right that, you know, as an underground drug, meth was at first a biker drug. How did it become
right.
a biker drug?
Well, what happens is that a bunch of Korean War veterans in the late 50s come back to the San Francisco Bay Area, and doctors start prescribing injectable methamphetamine to these heroin addicts to wean them off heroin. And I know that sounds incredibly strange, but some doctors sincerely believed that by substituting a downer with a strong stimulant, you could actually wean people off heroin. Now, of course, what happened was all these heroin addicts became methamphetamine addicts. So the California Attorney General asked the pharmaceutical companies not to supply injectable methamphetamine to California anymore. And they actually did that. So basically, methadrine, injectable legal methamphetamine, was withdrawn from the market. And in response, the first illegal speed labs, speed is what they used to call methamphetamine, these speed labs sprung up in the San Francisco area. And I mean, basically, the bikers were involved right in the beginning. It was basically like a Korean War veterans. But the bikers were employed essentially as delivery boys. They were used to deliver the drug throughout the rest of California and also into the Midwest and throughout the rest of the United States. Over time, the bikers learned how to make meth, and so then they could control the whole process. They basically made the drug and also transported the drug across the United States. And then that's how they came to control the market.
And you said that there were a lot of biker labs in the Ozarks starting in about the mid-70s.
Right. Yeah, sure. Especially with the old biker meth, the meth that the Hells Angels and the Pagans used to make, that was a very smelly process. It was a big laboratory, and the chemicals used, I mean, P2P was the main chemical used. It's a very, very smelly chemical. So they needed rural areas, and they needed rural areas with very sparse law enforcement presence. And the Ozarks provided the perfect setting for that. I mean, you know, the Ozarks has a long tradition of home distilling that goes back, you know, centuries. So it kind of fit right in the Ozarks. It was easy to set these labs up there, to hide them, you know, in pig farms or in other, you know, out of the way locations. And so that's why, you know, that's why I think the Angels chose the Ozarks as a major manufacturing center.
You described someone named Bob Palette as having decentralized the local meth trade, and he started making meth himself, and his recipe became known as Nazi dope.
Right.
What was different about his recipe?
Well, what was different about his recipe was that it was a very simple process. He claims that that's how the Nazis made meth during World War II, the meth they supplied to their battlefront troops. I don't think that's the case, but anyway, the name stuck. And basically, what was interesting about this method was it was a simple method that used anhydrous ammonia, which had never been, and lithium metal, which had never been used before in the United States. Now, anhydrous ammonia is a very common chemical in the Ozarks in the spring growing season. You see these white tanks everywhere, which are full of anhydrous ammonia. They're basically used to fertilize the ground. So he, you know, invented this new way of making meth using this chemical that was very easily accessible in the Ozarks. And he kind of taught this method to other people he knew who went on to teach other people who went on to teach other people. So it became like a giant pyramid scheme. And so rather than having to buy meth from the bikers, people, you know, meth addicts and meth users could now make their own meth using chemicals they could find just locally.
But that was kind of dangerous, not only because of the meth itself, but also because anhydrous ammonia is a very explosive chemical. So that means that there was a very dangerous chemical around.
Technically, it's not explosive. It has a very low boiling point. So it basically, what it does is, if it's exposed to air, it turns into this kind of noxious gas that, if it touches the skin, it kind of peels back the skin. So you get, it's like coal burns. You know, it's like if you're in like a really cold environment, that it will kind of burn your skin. And if you inhale it into your lungs, it will frost your lungs, you know. So it doesn't explode. It's not an explosive, but it is very, very dangerous. And there's been numerous deaths reported, you know, because basically what these people do is they go to these tanks with an empty fire extinguisher or one of those propane tanks you get when you go camping, and they decant the anhydrous into these other containers. And if you don't do it properly, the thing will, you know, you inhale some of the fumes or it leaks out, then it can quite easily kill you.
I guess what you've told us about the Ozarks becoming a kind of capital for meth labs explains how Missouri became such a central place for meth.
Right. I mean, there always was a meth culture in Missouri. I think in the book you see that, you know, there was an article in Time magazine from 1959, and it was about in Oklahoma City, Missouri. It's about these teenagers, you know, injecting meth, and at the time, you could buy it over the counter from chemists. It was called a Valo inhaler, and basically people would use it legitimately for, you know, asthma and breathing problems. And basically you would just break open the container, and you would take the wick inside out, which was, you know, full of pure methamphetamine, and they would dunk it into a cup of hot water, and then they would take a syringe, slurp up the liquid and inject it into their arms. So this was 1959, and this is Time magazine, so you've got to figure if Time magazine discovered it in 1959, it was probably happening several years earlier than that. So we're talking about a problem that had been around for decades, but it was when everybody and the mother could cook their own meth, that's when it really started to become like a crisis in the Ozarks.
My guest is Frank Owen, author of the new book, No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Frank Owen, and his new book is called No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. And it's a history of meth. In writing about the history of meth, you say that during World War II, all of the sides in the war were using amphetamines for their soldiers. Can you tell us a little bit about how soldiers were using amphetamines in the war?
Well, amphetamine and methamphetamine, it had long been known that they boosted energy, they decreased tiredness, they suppressed hunger, they made you more aggressive. Perfect drug for the battlefield, you know? Didn't have to eat, didn't slow down, could kill and kill and kill. So, yeah, it was a perfect drug. It's also a drug that, as I said before, it's a drug that focuses concentration. So they could actually take the drug without getting too stoned, it wasn't as if they were taking, 500 milligrams. They were taking pill form, so it was like 5, 10, 15 milligram doses. But methamphetamine seemed particularly useful in a battlefront situation because of all those reasons I cited.
One of the people you write about was nicknamed Uncle Fester. His real name is Steve Pressler, is it pronounced?
Pressler. Yeah.
And he was a meth cook in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And he had written a guide for terrorists teaching them how to make things like botulinum, ricin, and sarin gas.
It's called Silent Death.
And then he wrote a recipe book for meth, and that was called Secrets of Methamphetamine Manufacture, a handbook for making crystal meth. So how did this book change meth labs and meth distribution?
Well, up until that point, recipes to make meth were essentially kind of like forbidden knowledge, people passed around these recipes. People paid for these recipes. They were, if you wanted to buy a meth recipe, it would cost you a lot of money. So Secrets of Methamphetamine Manufacture basically was the first book that made these recipes available to the general public, and also the first book where the recipes actually worked, because Pressler's a trained chemist, so he actually knows what he's talking about. Whereas, before, meth manufacturing was a kind of, this kind of practice that was surrounded in myth and legend. Some recipes might work, other recipes wouldn't work, So he kind of almost codified the process of making meth, and the book sold a lot of copies. So, and the book, everywhere you go, basically in the United States, anybody who's making meth in a home lab knows this book, has read this book, or learned to make meth using this book. I mean, there's two ways they learn to cook. They learn to cook by watching other people, or they learn to cook by reading this book.
Did you meet Steve Pressler?
Oh yeah, sure. We spent a boozy weekend together. Like watching wrestling at this local sports bar and talking politics. And yeah, he's a very ordinary guy, very blue collar guy, not at all weird, not strange, not crazy. He could be any blue collar guy in any small town or any city in America, except he writes these incendiary books that, drive the DEA crazy.
Is he still making meth?
No. Well, that's what he tells me. People speculate that he must have some meth lab hidden away because he constantly revises the text, because there's always like new you know, new recipes, new ways of making meth. And so he's put out, I think he's on his, what, sixth, seventh edition now. So people think, oh, he must have a meth lab somewhere. But, you know, he's followed constantly by the DEA and by the local police. So if he really did have a meth lab, I think they would probably know about it. So I take him at his word. He says he hasn't made meth in well over a decade.
Did he seem to have any regrets about having helped so many people become addicts?
No, he takes great pride in it.
Why does he take pride in that?
Well, you know, he's a kind of, I guess what you would call a kind of right-wing anarchist, you know. He really hates the government because, you know, the government put him in jail for 6 years for manufacturing meth, and he sees this as his way of getting back at the government, that by teaching, you know, all these kids how to make meth, you know, it's payback for the 6 year prison term he did. You know, I mean, he takes no responsibility whatsoever for the kind of negative consequences of this knowledge. As far as he's concerned, he just writes the books, and what people do with that knowledge is up to them.
Frank Owen's new book is called No Speed Limit: The Highs and Lows of Meth. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at TIAACREF.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Liv Ullmann talks about working with director Ingmar Bergman. He died today at age 89. Also, the place of India and China in what journalist Robin Meredith describes as the disassembly line. We'll talk with Meredith, who covers both countries for Forbes. Also, how Mexican cartels took over the meth trade. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Frank Owen, author of the new book, No Speed Limit: The Highs and Lows of Meth. It's a history of methamphetamine. Earlier, we talked about how mom and pop meth labs developed around the country, but new laws have succeeded in shutting down many of those labs. What are some of the ways that federal government and state governments have cracked down on chemicals that are used to make meth?
Well, basically every chemical that goes to make meth these days is controlled in some way or another. But the problem is, this is what they call a supply-side measure, right? You can cut off the chemicals, but it does nothing about the demand for the drug. So this recent round of chemical controls, for instance, is the Combat Meth Act, which you may have heard of. And that basically, you know, if you go to Walgreens or your local pharmacy and you want to buy some cold medicines, you have to show ID and you have to sign this form and you usually have to get it from the manager, and there's this whole rigmarole. Now, the thing about that is, it's been incredibly successful. There's been a huge drop off in these so-called mom and pop labs, these small-time independent operators, massive decrease. But what's happened is that created a void, and so now the Mexican cartels have come in and they're the ones now supplying all the meth. So what you have is, instead of a situation where you have this patchwork quilt of local meth scenes with these independent operators supplying these local markets, now you have a situation which is actually more like the cocaine business. It's this drug is made abroad, then it's smuggled into the country. And so now you have, instead of the meth trade being controlled by hillbillies and bikers, you have the meth trade controlled by these very sophisticated Mexican polydrug organizations, very violent, whose leaders never even set foot in the country.
So now that Mexican labs and the Mexican crime world has gotten involved with making and distributing meth, that means if you're buying meth that's from the Mexican labs, that you're kind of getting more connected to the criminal underground.
Right.
And also the drug, I believe, has become much more expensive.
Much more expensive and much stronger. One of the ironies of these attempts to suppress meth is the harder they crack down on it, the stronger the drug gets. This drug, this Mexican ice that you can buy like where I am at the moment in New York City, it's $240 a gram, and it's like anything from 92 to 98% pure. It will blow your socks off, you know, and it's much more powerful than what these small mom and pop labs were making, you know. And, you know, the Mexicans have quality control. Stuff that comes from the small independent operators, it varies greatly, the potency of the drug. You know, it all depends on the skill of the chemist. The Mexican cartels have professional labs with professional chemists, and they're able to deliver the strongest version of meth yet available to the American consumer.
How's the Drug Enforcement Agency trying to deal with Mexican meth?
Well, you know, a lot of it is diplomacy. I mean, you know, the DEA has no jurisdiction in Mexico. So a lot of this occurs at the diplomatic level with the State Department and, you know, trying to get, the Mexican government to crack down on these guys. But, you know, it's not hardly a secret that you know, Mexico is a very corrupt country. And the history of drug trafficking from Mexico into America is that these drug traffickers are protected from on high, you know, the Mexican military, Mexican police, Mexican politicians. So in order to eliminate Mexican meth, you would literally have to reform, you know, the Mexican political structure from top to bottom. So there's a lot of talk about, we'll extradite this drug dealer and that drug dealer. And, you know, the Amezcua brothers, who were the big kingpins of meth in the 1990s, I mean, they eventually imprisoned those guys. But, you know, these guys go to prison, but it doesn't seem to stop meth coming into this country. You know, you can take down, you know, a couple of cartel leaders and others will take their place. So it does seem rather like a kind of something of a losing battle.
When you were researching the new Mexican meth, you tried it.
Yes.
And I was
yes.
kind of reading
Mexican
your book.
Mexican ice, they call it.
Yeah, reading your book, I was wondering why you did that. Since you used to have a meth problem, did you feel like it was dangerous to try it again, even if it was, in your mind, just research?
Well, I wanted to try it because it was different from the meth I used to do. The meth I used to do was the old biker meth. And, people have been talking to me about this Mexican ice and saying how powerful it was and, you know, and just how much more different it was from the old meth. And, you know, I was curious to find out, you know, just how powerful it was. And I thought I was being very responsible. I mean, I just bought half a gram. I mean, it was barely covered the bottom of a bag. And I split it up into 8 lines. And I had 2 lines a day for 4 days. And I thought, wait, what can go wrong, you know? I mean, these weren't like huge big lines. These were tiny little lines. But, you know, I underestimated just how powerful this drug was. I mean, half a gram, you know, nearly drove me crazy. And it's kind of, you know, it was rather than that chapter, it comes at the end of a chapter which says, you know, that the more they've cracked down on meth, the stronger it's got. And rather than just kind of citing, you know, oh, this is 98% pure compared to like it was 80% pure like 10 years ago, I thought it'd be interesting just to show just how powerful it was. And I think, you know, I think that's what I did do. It's not something I would do again in a hurry. It was extraordinarily powerful.
Well, Frank Owen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frank Owen is the author of No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. Coming up, what the iPod has to tell us about China, India, and the global economy. This is Fresh Air. Robin Meredith has been watching India and China transform their economies and the global economy. She's a foreign correspondent for Forbes magazine and covers both countries. She's written a new book called The Elephant and the Dragon, The Rise of India and China and What It Means for All of Us. Robin Meredith, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the iPod because it's connected to both China and India. Would you explain how?
Absolutely. The iPod is such a great example of globalization today and about how India and China are connected to the global economy and to our daily lives. The iPod is a product so many of us Americans use every day, but the chip that is the brains of the iPod was invented in Hyderabad, India. I've actually been to the company that makes it. It was invented in the basement of a bungalow of a neighborhood in Hyderabad. And when you go there, they'll open up a closet proudly to show you that the computers in their little bungalow will never go down. Why? Because there's a stack of car batteries that serve as the backup power in case the electricity shuts off periodically in Hyderabad, which it doesn't want to do. Nonetheless, a small team of people in Hyderabad invented the brains of the iPod. They offered it to Apple. Apple said, oh, this is great, and bought into their vision of how you could really transform the music industry. Apple then designed this beautiful product that has really revolutionized the music industry, and it's interesting because the actual iPod itself is made almost exclusively in China, often by Taiwanese and other foreign subcontractors. So here we have what is happening more and more often for products sold in America. We have a product, the idea of which have come from India, the manufacturing of it takes place in China, and then it is shipped over to America, where an American company distributes and markets it, and, by the way, makes the lion's share of the profits from the product. The Indian company gets paid, the Chinese and Taiwanese companies get paid, but the lion's share of the profits stay with Apple.
You know, your new book is about the economies of China and India. What other connections do you see between the two? I mean, obviously, one of the connections is that you've been covering both of them, but there,
yes,
there are other comparisons that you make.
Well, sure. You know, it's funny. The biggest, most important thing for me about India and China, the one thing about them that's really similar, is that they're these giant nations, each with more than 1 billion people, that are embracing both globalization and capitalism at the same time. And that a change of that magnitude hasn't happened in a very, very long time. Many economists say that the most recent event of similar magnitude to shake the world economy was when America itself walked onto the world economic stage. So it's very, very important. It's a very big change. Aside from that, India and China are in so many ways absolute opposites. Of course, India's democratic, China's authoritarian. But in many, many other ways, they're as opposite as Gandhi and Mao.
What are some of the ways that they're opposite?
Well, when you go to India, you see just a riot of bright colors, and you find a cacophonous nation, you know, one with 30 different languages, including English. On the other hand, you also see airports and roads that are just unbelievably shabby. The time zone in India mystifies. It's a half hour off from every place else in the world. So when it's noon in Philadelphia, it's 9:30 at night in Bombay. It's very, very confusing. China's the opposite of that. It's completely straightforward. The national language is Mandarin. The clocks line up with the rest of the world. The Communist Party runs the country with an iron hand. And the roads and airports there are all brand new. That's really helping China connect its factories with the world of consumers.
So it's kind of paradoxical that the, you know, communist government is making it easy for capitalists because everything is...
Isn't it funny?
Yeah, everything falls into line. Everything is done in a certain way.
Exactly. Even the five-year plans, the old-fashioned five-year plans of the Communist Party, actually help Western businesses doing business there know what it is the Chinese government has as a priority and know what they'll be spending money on. That makes it a lot easier for them.
You give histories of how both India and China became global economic powers, and you compare their different approaches to getting there. You point in your book that India is the first place that white-collar jobs were really exported to on a large scale from mm-hmm. the United States. And you say that that kind of white-collar offshoring, particularly in the high-tech industry, came about by accident. What was the accident?
Well, when America got caught in the Y2K scare, we worried that when 1999 New Year's Eve rolled around and became 2000, that our computers would stop working. And suddenly, there was a huge demand from corporate America to reprogram their corporate computer system so that they didn't crash. And there weren't enough programmers in America, particularly ones that used some older programs, and were familiar with those, to reprogram them all in time before midnight on December 31st, 1999. So a lot of that work was outsourced almost as an experiment to India. And then when the work was done successfully, American companies thought, hey, this is great. It only cost a tenth of what it cost in the United States. And it was done quickly. And the quality was very high. What else can we start moving to India? And then a lot of computer work began to move to India, computer programming in particular. Then after the computer programming work moved, American companies said, wait a minute, I bet we could do other things there. And so now, if you were an American and you didn't do your own taxes and you hired a big accounting firm to do them for you, most likely your taxes were prepared by an Indian accountant. The Hollywood movie that you're watching, if it's animated, much of the animation may have been done in India rather than at home in the United States. There are all kinds of jobs that you're not necessarily aware of that are moving to India. And they're higher and higher level jobs. They're not just call centers in which people call 800 numbers and reach an operator in India. Those are moving too. But the economics make sense for a number of other jobs. And that's what's so alarming, I think, about the global job market.
That we're losing jobs in America to other countries.
Yes, and simply that... You know, the economic transformation of India and China means that suddenly we have a global job market. We didn't used to have a global job market at all. It didn't exist. But in the last 10 years, about a billion people have been added to the global labor pool. And that's one out of four workers around the world. So all of those workers in India and China earn dramatically less than Westerners. And I have seen this on my many trips to India and China as a foreign correspondent, and it's alarming to me because I don't think most Americans realize that this is happening and that it's so easy for companies to move jobs around the world. And what it means is that Americans can no longer expect to earn 10 times more than everyone else for the same work. We just can't.
My guest is Robin Meredith, and she's a journalist with Forbes magazine. She's an international correspondent and has been covering India and China. Her new book is called The Elephant and the Dragon, The Rise of India and China and What It Means for All of Us. You know, China's had this terrible crisis with the contaminated pet food and toothpaste and defective products. The head of the Chinese equivalent of the FDA was executed for taking bribes. Is execution typical in China for white-collar crime?
It is, especially for corruption. China executes more prisoners than any other country in the world. Beijing has been trying to stamp down on the problem, the very prevalent problem of corruption, for some time. So the Food and Drug Administrator who was executed was one of a number of Chinese officials who have been executed as punishment for corruption over the last few years. And the deterrent doesn't seem to be working too well, because China has and will have into the future a really terrible corruption problem. I don't see it being stamped out. Beijing has struggled with it for years and years and years.
Do you think that there's a fear now of the Made in China label, and that China's ability to export on the level that it has is going to be affected by these recent scares, these recent problems?
I think there should be a fear of the Made in China label for certain products. I'm very concerned about Chinese food, food grown in China. And the reason is that as we see, you clearly cannot trust Chinese regulators to... you can't trust the stamp of approval of a Chinese regulator. They're quite often corrupt around the country. Even Hu Jintao, the Chinese president, would admit so. And I think that's really worrisome. The other big problem is the environment. If food that's grown in China, even if it isn't contaminated with chemicals that are not technically allowed to be used, is grown under acid rain in almost every corner of the country. China's air is extremely, extremely polluted, and I just don't think that could be good for us. So I think that the recent scandal over and scare involving pet food and tainted toothpaste was really, really useful both for American consumers and American companies that are buying and importing Chinese goods and then putting their label on them. Because for consumers, it's a wake-up call that reminds you you want to know where your food is grown and where some of the more sensitive products you use, like toys that your children play with, for instance, are made. And for companies, it's a wake-up call because they need to know that it's their brand, the American brand, that will be damaged if they don't rigorously test products that they're buying from China and make sure that they're safe.
Well, how does this affect what you eat and what you purchase when you're in China?
If you're in China, you can't really avoid eating food grown in China. But I'm based in Hong Kong. I try to buy produce, certainly, and any fish from Australia.
Well, Robin Meredith, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Robin Meredith is a foreign correspondent for Forbes. Her new book about India and China is called The Elephant and the Dragon. Coming up, actress Liv Ullmann talks about director Ingmar Bergman. Bergman died today at age 89. This is Fresh Air. More persuasively than any other director, Ingmar Bergman has mapped out the geography of the individual psyche, its secret yearnings, and its susceptibility to memory and desire. So wrote Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times Magazine in 1983. The great Swedish director died today at the age of 89. Bergman made more than 50 films, The Seventh Seal, Wild Strawberries, and The Magician among them. His 1960 film, The Virgin Spring, won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film, as did his film Fanny and Alexander in 1982. Bergman's last work before he retired from filmmaking was Saraban, made for Swedish public television in 2003. It starred his longtime collaborator, the Norwegian actress Liv Ullmann. She starred in many of his films, including Persona, Shame, Face to Face, Cries and Whispers, and Scenes from a Marriage. She had a brief romantic relationship with Bergman, and they had a daughter together. I spoke with Ullmann about Bergman in 1993. What's the story of how you made your first film, Persona, with Ingmar Bergman, who directed it, and Bibi Andersson, who co-starred with you?
Well, I'd been an actress for many, many years, actually. Then in Norway, 8 years, and I was a leading actress in the National Theatre of Oslo. I'd done many Norwegian and Swedish films at that time, and I met Bibi Andersson on a Swedish film and went to visit her in Stockholm. And on the street we were walking and we met Ingmar Bergman, and like in the books, although it wasn't Lana Turner, I was Ingmar Bergman looked at me and said, "Would you like to do a film with me?" And I thought that was a glib thing to say, and so I just blushed and said yes. And but the film then that he had in mind, where I had a small part, that never happened because he became ill. But while in the hospital, he had kept this image of Bibi and me on the street, and he had seen a photograph of us and struck by our likeness. He was in the hospital and he wrote in a week a film, Persona, based on the likeness between two women. And it turned out to be, a really very special film in film history. Today, many have made films like that, but at that time, it was a first, and it's a classic film.
In Persona, you play an actress who is very depressed, going through like an existential crisis, and you've given up speaking. And Bibi Andersson plays your nurse. There are many scenes in which you're staring into the camera or staring just off into space, and there's just incredible intensity on your face, registering this absence, this feeling of kind of groping for meaning. What were you thinking about during those long scenes in which the camera is just observing your naked face?
Well, I don't really know. I've seen the pictures since then, and I was so young, actually, when I did it. I was 27, and the one thing I did understand was that I was doing Ingmar Bergman, and that's what I continued to do in a lot of the films. And just because he wanted to work with me, he made the role into a woman's role instead of a man's role. I was too young, really, to understand what an existential crisis was. And I was kind of a happy person, and it hadn't occurred to me that one has such crises. And today I understand much more. But I think my luck was that I somehow recognized Bergman and saw it's him I'm portraying. So I watched him, and I did him on camera.
What did you find in his face or in his body that you borrowed for that role?
Oh, this young boy. I saw a picture of him as a schoolboy when he was 11, and you can just see this boy doesn't have many friends, and he has all these pimples, and it's just somebody wanting to come out and say, "Hi, here I am, please see me." And that's what I saw in this grown man who was, 21 years older than me. And I borrowed that. So if you say I'm looking intently into space and all that in Persona, I think I was trying to show this person, wanting to communicate, wanting to be part of the world, but not knowing how to, and then deciding I'm not going to speak. I'm just going to go into myself and hide from people.
Now, you and Ingmar Bergman became lovers. Was it ever a strain having a lover who was older and was also the boss, the director? I mean, you had it's sometimes an awkward position to be in, to have the person who you're most intimate with also be the person who's giving you directions.
Well, I tell you, it wasn't like living with Bob Hope. And you know, when we met for breakfast, tell me about his nightmares, I knew I was going to star in them in his next film. But and actually, we did Persona, and then I only did two films for him while we lived together. The bulk of the work we had done together was after our personal relationship was all over. But those two films, oh, that was no fun, you know. The others, when the day was over, they could go and have fun and be together and so, but I had to go home with the boss, and this was really a boss, you know, in existential crisis. And yeah, that was kind of tough.
So was it more relaxing to act after your relationship with him had ended?
Yeah, well, I tell you, you know, he is not as dark as his films seem to say, nor, you know, while we're doing the films, even the dark ones. There is so much laughter and fun working with Ingmar Bergman.
Liv Ullmann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Liv Ullmann recorded in 1993. Director Ingmar Bergman died today at age 89. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. From hotels.com, with virtual tours, customer reviews, and over 70,000 properties to choose from, online or at 800-3-HOTELS. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at AnnenbergFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Paul Rudd talks about his experiences making Knocked Up, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and Anchorman. He stars in the new film, The Ten. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.